my mic. What?
Hello, and welcome to recording number 23 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is August 19th. Pardon me. Today is August 19th, 2021. We just had Gord and Geller and Chert, who are in the Cat Lord's plane, meet with the Cat Lord, and now they're being transported to Tensor, where Tensor is supposedly going to help them out. So we're going to get some information. We've been hearing a little about Mordenkainen. We've gotten to meet Melf, and now we're going to hopefully meet Tensor here. I believe there's even a picture of Tensor's castle. All right, I'm going to restart on page 211. It is the fourth paragraph down from the top of the page. The gray nothingness, without any of the unpleasant sensations that had previously accompanied their transference to the domain of the Cat Lord, washed over them for an instant. Then they were within a sunny round chamber, standing within the outlines of a series of circles and cabalistic diagrams set into the stone floor in strips of various sorts of metal and other substances. The room was unoccupied except for themselves. "I smell the scent of the lake," Gord said as he stepped out of the magical diagram and went to gaze out one of the windows that pierced the circumference of the chamber, one facing each of the cardinal compass points, if the sun was any indication. "To refer to the near div, of course," drawled the one-eyed bard, as he and Chert joined their companion, and all of them gazed at the panorama revealed by the window. Pardon me. "There are other great bodies of water besides that one, you know. I'm provincial, not a world traveler such as you, Geller," Gord said as he inhaled deeply. "Of those other so-called lakes, I know nothing. Besides, the smell of the near dev is unique, like perfume." "Or like seaweed and fish," the big barbarian said, as he sniffed at the breeze wafting in off the sparkling sheet of blue water, which stretched northward as far as the eye could see. The three men made a circuit of the chamber, peering from each window in turn. They were at the top of the tallest tower of the castle, Tensor's castle, evidently, although that worthy had not made an appearance yet. The shore of the lake ran gently northeastward from the place the stronghold was built, and Gord hazarded a guess that they were somewhere along the lake's large mid-bay, in territory claimed by neither Greyhawk nor Ernst. The cliff-lined shore, rocky verge, and sheer hills of the region made it unpopular with sailors, and the barge folk alike. It was a fine place for someone who didn't care for unexpected company. All right, break. Now, we're on 213, but on 212, and Chris has put it up. On 212, there is a picture here of Tensor's castle. And we get, I believe it's Easley. It reminds me of a real-world castle, probably Bavarian or German. No, if you notice, like the round towers, and the largest tower with the capped top is reminds me of a lot of things I've seen of kind of Germanic castles. And then we get a little slice of up here on the text channel of the near dev from Darlene's map. And it's got this section called Mid-Bay and a prominent little point coming out right there. It is, it's, you know, the southern slopes are surrounded by the Carn Hills, and Greyhawk is actually not too far from Mid Bay off of the Sellaton. All right. I'm going to, you know, we have a little information about this summoning chamber or transportation chamber at the top of Tensor's highest tower. And at least there is some link from the Cat Lord's domain to Tensor's castle here. All right, so there's a location of interplanar travel right there. All right, I am going to restart. It's page 213, second paragraph. The castle itself seemed to have grown from the rocky spire of an ancient mountain, worn to a nub by time and the elements. There were similar tours round about, but this one thrust up in a place where its neighbors were distant. In fact, the prominence stood in a valley, small and rigid, but a valley nonetheless. A creek ran down the southern slope of the ridge at the lower part of the U-shaped valley, passed along the western side of the fortress, and sped in its deep-cut channel to fall into the lake beyond. Steep-sided cliffs and streambed made the castle nearly unassailable by usual methods. Ford supposed that there were many protections against magical attack as well. The place rambled along the natural contours of the rock. Far below was a wall that surrounded the place, where it was pierced for entry where barbican, drawbridge, gatehouse, and portcullis. Turrets and bartizans stuck here and there at the angles were proof against any portion of the maculated battlements having attackers ascend unmolested. A grassy strip of varying breadth grew between this wall and the rest of the works, although there was a separate bailey from the gate to the place where the rock had been hewn to allow entry into the central spire. Along the paved road were square stone buildings that formed a parallel set of walls to confine those entering the gate to a narrow way. From the spire rose the roof of a great hall, and several lesser constructions, tied by walks and bridges of stone blocks, crenellated and showing pierced mirlons for archery. The ancient rock of the mountain had been hardest where the great tower rose. About half of its 70-foot height was this core, shaped but little by tools, embrasured between natural buttresses of living stone. "A hard place to assault," Geller murmured, "and I'll wager that there are roofs and shutters of metal to place when this place is besieged." "I prefer the open," Church said in a reply, "to being bottled up in some little place such as this." Laughing at the truth of that, Geller and Gord began searching for some means of egress. The barbarian joined them gladly. They could find neither stairs nor trap door. They were prisoners, it seemed. "Where is this Tensor?" said Chert angrily. "Major, no, I have words for one who provides no means of leaving his hospitality." Suddenly the floor in the center of the chamber became as transparent as water. Only a faint reflection revealed that something other than air occupied the space where great slabs of polished gneiss had formerly been seen. Then a strange metallic voice rang out. "Welcome to my castle. I just discovered that you were already here, and I regret not greeting you sooner. If you will step onto the transparent section of floor, you will be with me shortly." All right, break. Now, Chris has given us little things, a little definition here of all the various castle talk we've done. Barbican, an outward or forward extension of a castle gateway. All these should come with little pictures, because as soon as you see them, you'd recognize them from from miniatures, from movies, from actual castles. If you've been there or seen pictures of them, you know, and about like maculations is a projection in the battlement of a wall with openings through which missiles could be dropped on besiegers. Normally, I've seen the maculations as a wooden structure that kind of fits on top of the wall, where there'd normally be like a walkway and the merlons, the blocks with the openings between, you know, like a set of square teeth. That would be built to overhang the top of the wall, give the archers protection, and also allow things to be dropped straight down. It's very good when you're worried about scaling ladders, or even against, because it can be dropped. It's just an extra wooden structure on the outside of a wall. So here, Chert gets his answer right there. And Tenser keeps this way unavailable for any egress except through magical, or perhaps somebody flying, you know, or a flying creature that could come up through one of the four windows in the top tower. And, you know, we get a little thing about how well constructed. And this tower is supposed to be made out of the hardest part of the mountain rock that is at the worn down mountain here. And it's the tallest tower is, it's not like constructed of blocks of stone. It's more that it's carved out of the stone that is already there at the top of this mountain. All right.
The one thing I posted there about the valleys, it says it's a U-shaped valley. I know this isn't Earth, but in Earth terms, a U-shaped valley is formed by glaciation, and a V-shaped valley is formed typically by a river. So it could be evidence of an ice age in Greyhawk.
Well, I wouldn't doubt that. I mean, I would say that even if it doesn't make geological sense the way Greyhawk is set up, you know, you have to take in that the this is not Earth, and we really don't know if everything works in the same way because of the various things that are going on. And with magic thrown in, practically anything can happen. So, yes, I would definitely have an ice age at some point in the past. Maybe even have that as the fall of the great elven kingdoms. You know, I would think, that could be when, the dwarves might have retreated deeper into their mountains, and the elves might have lost forests, and, rather than being defeated by man, I just wonder if at that age, with the Ice Age, there may have been just a natural occurrence that drove the, split up the great elven empire, and maybe destroyed the interconnection of the forest. I was watching a Twitch stream, Jay's Twitch stream, and Anna was commenting on how, all the Flaness may have been heavily forest all the way through at some point. And I would think that'd be very interesting to have an ice age when man was still primitive, but even the elves and dwarves and other creatures, they had to withdraw because of the coming of the ice. And if you see that really one of the most structured elven areas left is Selene, and if there was an ice age, imagine how the ice may have just covered all the north and maybe pushed all the way down to where Selene is, and that may have forced the elves, to have that. Selene may have been one of the places that was able to resist the ice age, but all speculation here, but isn't that wonderful? I mean, here, this is just a little tidbit information, and yet we can think about how it can lead to so many other things. Now, this isn't anything planned by Gygax, but that is something, you know, it's very, you find this inspiration, I find this book with a lot of inspiration in it.
Yeah, I was thinking how interesting it was that, like, such a small little phrase could have such widespread implications.
Yes, and, you know, there are so many connections, and it's easy to ignore them, but, you know, things happen for a reason. It's like they used to harness horses, an oxen, with this throat halter. And they were not able to do as much work because the more pressure they put on it, it came against their throat. And those halters, a horse could work as much as four men wearing those halters. But then when they came across the shoulder and they put those things so the halter was resting instead of on the throat and neck, it was resting on the horse's shoulder, suddenly the horse was able to do 20 times as much as a man. And that's when, you know, a lot of farming really expanded, and it was a tremendous innovation. And, you know, so, yeah, and little things can have huge connections. It's like, you know, when Europeans, and for a long time, they did not realize that about the stirrup. They would have these complicated saddles, but they had no stirrups. And what the stirrup does, it lodges you firmly. Your feet get locked into the, you brace your feet against these stirrups. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of riding boots have heels, so you can lock into the stirrup. Now, what that allowed you to do is that when you came in contact with somebody with a spear or a lance, you could put the force of the horse behind that blow. Where in the past, if you did not have the stirrup, when you charged with a spear or a lance, you ended up getting knocked off the horse. So it really changed. And the invention of the stirrup completely changed what men on horseback could do in combat. And, you know, it was a radical change. So here we have a comment that the Ice Age sounds really good. And yeah, there really is, you know, Anna Meyer's been really working on her Greyhawk Flaness map, and it is just, you know, it is just wild, the stuff that was, you know, so radically inconsistent in the makeup of Greyhawk, and you couldn't put it all down to magic and stuff. It just was, you know, rivers were flowing the wrong way, you know, like they just some places that should, like different temperatures, different kinds of vegetation, different kinds of areas instead of swamp or desert, just various things that did not make sense in her working out the specifics. So yeah, you know, Greyhawk's, you know, its geography is just, a little strange. And, most of it comes from just not understanding what should or shouldn't be when you're working at world building right there. And it's fine. It's absolutely fine. You don't really need to throw things and get very correct, but there's no reason not to have things work the way they should work.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. And I focus on stuff like that because part of my degree has a geography focus. And stuff like that, when I see terms like that, I was like, oh, what does that mean again? And I, you know, went and looked it up.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. That's very cool to think that, you imagine having, the near dev frozen solid and, you know, like the city, the area around the city of Greyhawk, you know, covered in snow and ice. And I would, I can picture Celine, as this area in the middle of an ice field, which is green and forested and everything, and holding out against the encroaching ice age.
Oh, and one more thing about those terms. If you go to that link that I posted at the top there, it's castlewales.com/castterms, and you click on hyperlinks on that webpage, there are pictures of most of those items.
Yeah, it's always handy. It's like Gary's pole arms. Gary Gygax loved pole arms, and every couple, you know, like you'd see in an issue or something of, like an issue of Dragon with like article with 20 or 30 pole arms that he liked to show off. And they were a very important part of combat, before, because the pole arm business started when, especially with the Greeks, their organized phalanxes of pole arm troops changed the style of battle. And then later on, when the horse became, cavalry became more predominant, the use of the pole arm, it again made the infantry much more useful, and the cavalry much less. But then, you know what? What that meant, though, was that the pole arm became very commonplace. You know, in medieval and battles where you wanted to hold off horsemen. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 214, and the fourth paragraph from the end. Gord took the opportunity to test the powers he had just learned his chrysoberyl ring possessed. Neither of his friends seemed eager to comply with the request, eyeing the clear floor suspiciously. "Come ahead," the young thief said confidently, as he stepped directly into the middle of the glass-like floor. "It's as solid as stone." He did not articulate that he had seen no trick or trap in the area when he had gazed carefully at it and thought hard, as the Cat Lord had instructed. Geller strode readily enough to stand beside Gord, even as he spoke about the firmness that his presence demonstrated. Chert was still nervous, and he moved his bulk gingerly, tiptoeing to take a position within the other two. Immediately upon his so doing, the floor yielded to their weight, and they sank only slightly more slowly than they would have in water. "Hopping hells," the barbarian yelled, trying vainly to grab the edge of the floor as he sank past. Geller and Gord, too, made clutching motions, but some force prevented them from grasping the edge of the solid floor they could clearly see. They sank through the floor of the next level of the tower, as well, some sort of laboratory, workroom, and library, from what little they could observe during the brief course of their passage. Again, they futilely attempted to hold on. As they sank yet further, however, their rate of descent slowed dramatically, and at the last they floated so softly that their feet barely felt a jolt when they came to rest on a thick rug that was but one of many rich carpets covering the chamber's floor. All right, break. Here's this elevator of tensors, and, you know, tensors floating disc. And the other thing, is that he changed the appearance, or he dispelled the floor of Gneiss, GNEISS, I believe. And then that's where their circular, invisible circular disc appeared that lowered them down two levels. All right. A restart's page 215, paragraph 2. "Most pleased to make your acquaintance, gentlemen," said a man of medium height and quick gestures. "I'm Tensor, of course, and you must be Geller, Chert, and this is Gord." As he spoke each name, he inclined his head curtly and smiled. "Please be seated," he went on, waving towards several chairs and a divan. The room was evidently his personal living quarters. There was a curtain bed, a small dining table, and other objects that showed the room to be a frequently used and well-loved domicile. Sir Tensor, despite the startling nature of our arrival, we are most happy to be here. Geller said in a stately tone, it almost seemed we were in prison for a time when we were above. Yes, I understand. However, such construction keeps unwanted snoopers out, and sometimes it keeps other sorts of things in, too, if you get my point. And break right here. And the comment is that gneiss is metamorphized granite, and very hard, resilient rock. So, yeah, that was where the circle was. Neither the disk is Tensor's floating disk, which seems very likely, or it's some version of it that has made the gneiss transparent and then lowered it to the floor. All right. I am on page 215, and it is third paragraph from the bottom. Gord, imagining what sort of creatures magic users often summon with their spells, agreed heartily that the lack of means to pass freely from floor to floor of the massive tower was a splendid one indeed. Tensor seated himself in an oddly carved chair with a high wooden back and a padded seat. The thing seemed very old, for the sheen of its wood was blue, the mark of ancient sablewood. The archmaid was clad in garments the shade of a robin's egg, with a sash of deep ultramarine and boots to match. Much of the room was also decorated in blue. Rugs, arras, and various and sundry decorative pieces. All shades and admixtures of azure were evident. Small wonder then that Tensor chose to build his keep on the shores of the bright blue lake of unknown depths. The man himself, however, had both brown hair and eyes, Gord noted. He was not remarkable until one observed him closely. Of medium height and build, the archmage seemed ordinary at first. His features were regular, although the nose was distinctive. One look at Tensor's large and penetrating eyes was sufficient to alert the discerning person that this was an exceptional character. His hands were large and long, long-fingered, and they moved with deceptive rapidity and grace. Gord felt that there was far more to the man than met the eye, and then realized that this was probably done by Tensor on purpose. Unproposing and mild, sure ways to put all off guard, no matter how. However, the Archmage was at worst a friendly neutral. When Catlord told me of the cause of the great disturbance in the energy flux, I began to investigate immediately, Tensor said. There is but little I have managed to glean. Powers contest with each other in the enemy camp. Each masks the action and purpose from the other. The enmity bodes well for all those of a disposition which resists the ascendancy of evil. Still, the struggle might bring woe to us, for the use of magic to find something, information, an object, whatever, is now virtually impossible. All right, break. And here's a little comment about the gneiss. It was found around places with histories of mountain building, and especially in geological shields at the center of continents. Gygax is spot on placing this here. There was probably plenty of gneiss around Wisconsin. All right. So what we've just read is a very nice little physical description of Tensor. And, you know, of course, his normal favorite about how he dresses, his love of blue and such. Some description of his house, you know, his castle here, you know, where the top level goes and such. And we, you know, now we also get this idea that he with Catlord. Now, again, that he, Gord, there's the talk of discernment and disguise. Because Gord is even using the thing that he can discern that there's more to this average-looking Tensor than meets the eye, and that there's a definite use of appearing unproposing to, you know, allay any suspicions by enemies. All right. All right. So let's see. I'm going to restart from here. Oh, I wanted to say that this comment here that foretelling and divination, because of what's been going on, you know, over this these evil artifacts, somehow it must have disrupted the ability to use magic to find information, you know, on a wider scale. And that, I believe, was what the artifact, the relic, that Gord and Chert and Curly got rescued from the Catabaline demon in Saga of Old City. That was meant to do things like find information and find out where these artifacts were. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 216 and paragraph 4th from the bottom. Geller asked the Archmage exactly what he was driving at. Tenser, it seemed, tended toward the pedantic, for he went on into a lengthy exposition. All spells draw upon one form of energy or another. Little ones use small energy. Big ones can draw tremendous currents. Those casting that utilize the power of some deity or another, those channeled through the medium of being of power, are of one sort, and the aura of such is distinct. Likewise, work of Diomer crafting leaves a unique signature, as it were. Oh, not the minor ones. Little spells are much the same as a rune or two written in the sand. But the major works leave a long and identifiable trace, at least for a time. Well and good, Archmage, I understand this, for I'm able to work a few minor spells myself. The one-eyed bard reminded Tenser. Just so. Your energies come from a fixed point, as does all. Each focal point is different, distinct and detectable. It is possible for those of great power to cloak theirs, however. I cannot. This place is built on a nexus, for I desired to have that advantage. Think on this. Of all probable worlds of this sort, Earth is most magical. There are fewer constraints on demon crafting and other spell working here than on other planes of probability. But that is a two-edged sword, so to speak. Imagine a map which glows with differing patterns and hues. It is a chart of energy points and flux lines on Earth and the nearby planes. It is hard to read, for both knowledge and patience are required. Furthermore, only certain ones with talent or power can even perceive it. When force is employed, the map's colors brighten, the lines change, the patterns shift, slight or otherwise, for an instant or longer, as I have already spoken of. Certain ones can observe these changes. Beings are now observing and interfering too. I can observe, but I am too insignificant to alter patterns, other than my own, of course, by use of energy. Small usage I can mask, but there are those who can hide far more. All the greater patterns and fluxes of Earth are being scrutinized. At the same time, those of beings elsewhere are being screened, altered, concealed. While this indicates still greater events than those, and even those which have recently occurred, it also means I am unable to draw upon any major energy without attracting attention and possibly retaliation of unwanted or of overwhelming sort. Perhaps I will have a part in the resolution of things. Perhaps not. Any action now would be premature. So I wait and gather my strength for the appropriate time. This boils down to the fact that I cannot send you to where you wish to go by means of magic. Tenser concluded with a solemnity That was as anticlimactic as his statement. Break. All right. So we're getting a really detailed version from Tensor. Mind you, this is not necessarily, this is, whether this is true or not, we're getting this from Tensor. He should know. But this is his, if you read this, this is his or perhaps Gygax's reasoning on how magic works. And it's always been a question. And so, you know, we're talking about limitations and, you know, the various things that are, like, if you're a cleric, you're getting a channel of energy flowing from your deity. If you are a magic user, you're using, you're drawing, using yourself to draw this force of energy that is around you. But when you cast spells, the spells themselves are leaving a trace in the force of the energy so that powerful creatures who can see this energy can detect the use of your spells. So that's, you know, that's a very, very interesting point here on both the mechanical side of things, of the, how the game is run, but also on the lore of it, how it works. And as Chris notes here, Earth is the most magical world, according to Tensor, the most magical world. You know, and it's noted too that Tensor has built his castle on a nexus of magic. So on Earth, there are points where perhaps a magic user will gain great benefits, extra spells or better effects, easier to memorize, as Tensor is on a nexus where his castle sits of magic coming out of the Earth. And you have to ask, what is that magic? And as is commented here, apparently Tensor never heard of Toril. And it is true. I mean, that is funny because Ed Greenwood was just recently on Jay Scott's Lord Gazumba show and on Twitch. And he was saying how he definitely wanted the Forgotten Realms to be incredibly magical. He wanted there to be tons of this stuff to the point where you weren't really going to be able to, as a DM, remember everything, or your players know everything, because there's so much in Toril or the Forgotten Realms. And yeah, so in the Toril definitely it seems to have more commonplace magic than Earth ever did. All right. I'm going to restart, and it is page 217, and it is paragraph 7 from the bottom. There's a lot of small one-line things here. All right, page 217. This evoked an immediate response from Gord, who was less interested in the technicalities of magic than Geller was, and not totally uninterested in uncomprehending as Chert was. Where should we be? There is a helix over Chendal. That is where we plan to go, said Gord. Perhaps the display is deceiving, the Archmage countered. If so, you must make a choice. Before the whole display became too dangerous and difficult for me to read, I believe I detected a curious flux pattern. Please explain this to us, Archmage, the one-eyed bard asked with renewed interest. Perhaps we can discern our course from what you have observed. Tensor drew himself up, puffed out his cheeks, and nodded. Who can know? Still, perhaps it will mean something to you. For a brief time, a Y-shaped pattern seemed to flow. It ran from the Kron Hills area straight toward Chendal. One arm stretched over the Vesvi Forest in the Valley of High Folk. The second was unstable, but arced toward the eastern shores of Whitestool Lake, vibrating as does a lute string when plucked. It all lasted but briefly, and then the spiraling helix replaced it as powers fought to cloak their designs. At this point, Tensor rose and left the chamber. The three adventurers began an animated discussion of what their course should be. The southern area was easily assessed and could be discarded as a possibility. They knew what was happening there, and that the elves of Selene and their allies must deal with it as best as they could. Certainly the second key traveled along one of the two arms of the Y-shaped force, but which arm? The one vibrating between Daraka and Molag showed the great tension between the Fa'aluz and the Hierarchs. Summoning of their deity indicated the Hierarchs thought the thing they sought to be near their southern border. But the flux showed that Uz might know otherwise. There was also the question of relative power. How was it that the Cambion, fell and terrible as Uz was, could resist such as Neral? Demonic assistance was the only reasonable conclusion. The left branch of the Y was a less certain clue. There might be interplay with the Archmage of High Folk, leagued with Morden Kanan in his circle of wizards, with a countering pull again emanating from Daraka. But why? What was transpiring along such a line? The thing Melf sought went northward from Littleburg with the brigand leader, Chert recalled. That's right. The stroke toward Chendal, the arm running in the northwest, one trail false, the other true, Gord cried in enthusiasm. The other sobered both young men by pointing out that the pattern might have indicated nothing more than points of power in conflict, a concord of such force or any number of other things. He then spoke encouragement. Yet the border areas between Furiondi and Valuna offers a good course for one seeking the safety of the Vesve, for what that wild forest could hide much. It is the only route that one journeying to meet with us could follow, what with the forces in the south seeking to prevent it, and the Horn Lords and their master ravening to the east. Finding a dwarf in the forest is as vain as seeking a needle in a haystack, Gord said gloomily. The barbarian brightened. Melf recounted how he once did just that, only the pin was magical, and there were a multitude of haystacks. He said he'd fired the lot and sifted the ash. Burning down the whole of the Vesve is impractical, to say the least, Geller commented dryly. His recounting the tale has merit, I think, Gord said as the barbarian slumped back in his chair at Geller's remark. If this Obmi has the second key, then Uz, much as Elf did, must locate Dwarf and Key and see them to Daraka. The smoke of such burning will leave a distinct trail. No petty escort will be sent to retrieve something so powerful as the piece of artifact. Gord, my young friend, Geller said with a beaming smile, you and Chert there are something more than a pair of sharp swords. I begin to think that your mind is keener than your enchanted blade you so prize. For between the two of you, you have put the point to the vitals. It is to the Vesvi forest shadowy depths we venture. How, the two young adventurers asked in unison. That is easy, interjected Tensor, as he strode into the chamber, if you do not fear water dragons. Break. That is page 219. And it is the end of chapter 19. We have them working out by using this method of looking at the flux. We have then working out how which way to go, and they've put together everything about Obmi, and it seems they're following the true clues on how to follow to Omni. And Chris has put up the water dragon, so I wonder if we're going to see some travel across the near dev right there.
I couldn't find a reference to a monster with the water dragon, but I found that picture.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm, you know, I'm sure might even be a Dragon magazine that had something on water dragons. There is some comment here. The previous comments were about how, Tenser says this Earth is the most magical. And then by Smedger's time, which is about, 400 years in the future, it is fading. And supposedly, yeah. And then there's also comment that the magical forces very much sound like the concept of ley lines. And, if, you know, Smedger, like everybody in this, even Tenser, everybody's unreliable. You know, it's just, we do not usually get an omniscient viewpoint in these stories. They're very personal. They're very much from personal points of view. And yes, who knows what other magics and forces there are, because all we're hearing about is a very small section of the Earth. And it is, it's a comment here that unreliable narrator is a mantra here. Yes, it certainly is. And it's certainly something I use all the time, because I do like to have people keep in mind that what is being said isn't exact truth as what, what is. It is simply what is the point of view from these various characters. All right, we are on chapter 20. We've got a little time left, so I'm going to begin. It is page 221, chapter 20, paragraph 1. The rush of green water became darker and more frightening as the monster dived deeper. Huge fish, dwarfed by the bulk of the creature, writhing through the depths, darted away in fear. Then a thing only a bit smaller than the monster swam up, but it was unwilling to cope with the ferocity of the would-be meal, and it sank out of sight almost immediately. The monster narrowed through the water 100 feet beneath the surface, and slowly the light above faded as the sun moved toward the unseen horizon in the east. In the west, I'm sorry. Gord could not speak. He and his friends and a strange, silent man rode the back of the great water dragon. Those things that would be harmed by immersion were sealed within a metal case as proof against damage. The case and the men were strapped to the scaly back of the monster. It swam so swiftly that even the stout straps would have been sundered were it not for a crystalline shield that sheltered their heads and upper bodies from the force of the water. Tenser had led them below his castle. Taking a labyrinthine route, they had eventually emerged in a large cavern filled with water. There lived the water dragon. Unlike the great dragon turtles, this creature had no carapace. It appeared much as would a red dragon, save its wings were vestigial, more like the great flukes of a whale, and its feet were webbed. The scales of the water dragon's back were aquamarine, and its underside color of old ivory. Where upper and lower scales met, there was a band of deepest sea-green color. The monster was beautiful in its way. It was also frightening in aspect. Tenser had explained that the creature wasn't a guardian of his fortress, but he would forgo its protection for... Oh, that the creature was a guardian of his fortress, but he would forgo its protection for a time in order for their party to be carried swiftly across the near Div to a place from where they could travel by other means. None of the men had understood just how swift their passage was to be. The spellbinder had somehow signaled, and the silent man and several servants had come into the cavern and attached the rig to the great dragon's back. It made no objection. Rather, the monster gazed fondly at the Archmage with its fish-like eyes, something that Gord could but wonder at, for never had he seen expression in the eyes of fish or reptile, or rather, he thought, any expression but cold hatred or ravening hunger. Tenser stroked the scaled muzzle and fed the dragon fish of 10 or 12 pound size. They were like minnows to the maw that snapped them up. Now, I have seen a water dragon, Geller exclaimed as he admired the great creature. They are rare, Tensor admitted. I have seen only two myself. And when this little fellow grows up, he will leave me for the depths of the ocean. So much for that. All right, here's a little break. Now, he has here mentioned that the water dragon, this is not a full-grown water dragon, and that they are incredibly rare, where Tensor himself has only seen two others. I wonder from the context if this may even be like a mated pair's young. And there we have this water dragon that through some means, perhaps charm or some other way, is looks to be completely, fond of and likes, charmed by Tensor. We've got a good description of the water dragon. We've got a little idea of Tensor's character, and we have a little description of Tensor's one tower and these catacombs beneath. So, you know, it's all nice little bits and pieces here, nothing too much in depth. Now, there's a comment here about yesterday when I was talking about the Cat Lord's dimension, wherever it is. I was talking about it and saying how similar it was to Tolkien in The Hobbit, where they made it to the safety of Beorn, and Beorn goes out and makes sure that everything is, okay. And that they're telling the truth and such, and the Cat Lord goes away for a bit and leaves them alone in his dimension there, in his mansion with all the other cats around it. So, in some ways, I think that at this point, Gygax does seem to be a bit on a limited rider. There are a number of things that have changed already. For one thing, the difference between this and Sog of Old City. Gygax had a tendency, especially with vulgarity and lower creatures, to really start talking in almost like a Chicago gangster from the 20s. And I found that a bit jarring back in Sog of Old City. Now, I don't see that at all here. I think, I remember an early Greyhawk story of his in Dragon Magazine, found it very poor. And I find these two much better. So I think Gygax was definitely learning his trade right here. But he has a lot of talents in this. And several of them are, like right in the beginning of this whole novel, he started out with a very nice opening. He had a lot more action in the chapters. He really got things going at the start of this story, which I think was a very well done for a second book. And, it's not just his setting material. He's wonderful with description. And he also has this ability of an intricate thinking where, he uses... He uses these ideas that call up questions that get revealed further along as the story progresses. And I find he's got a very decent style. He is no Lieber or Tolkien or C.L. Moore. He's a good writer, I think. There's still some... I think he could have used much better editing. But at the same time, I think Gygax himself seems to be, a very decent writer. And some of the sections we've gone through have been truly exciting to read. So, all right. So we've been introduced to this water dragon. They're flying across the near div. And then we hear, here's another one that comes up where we learn that the water dragon is going to keep growing. So, the two that he encountered must have been monstrous indeed. All right, it is page 222. I'm going to read a little more. Each of the three in turn was introduced to the monster. It hissed softly at each and took all of Gord's resolve not to tremble when his turn came. The creature was not showing anger or even given warning. However, when it vented the sound, the water dragon was intelligent and was acknowledging each man as not food. At least this is what Tenser had told them, and there was every reason to believe he spoke the truth. All the while, the Archmage crooned and made hissing noises to the monster, and it made odd sounds in reply. Now, break. Now, here we're going on about unreliable narrative, but you see in this last paragraph where Gord says, at least this is what Tenser, you know, about the dragons talking and dragons intelligent. And Gord thinks at least this is what Tenser had told him, and there's every reason to believe he spoke truth. So even Gord is looking at what he is being told, and he is not looking at it as 100% reliable. So that I think is significant, and I think it's a very important way to read through the book, is the understanding that what you're told is point of view, not written in stone. And it's a very good idea to look at this. Now, the other thing that moves out into the game world, when you are running Greyhawk, and you know, I'm an early Gygaxian and not later where the game was more fixed, but you as DM should look at everything that comes out, everything in this book, because there's things that Gygax did that I would never do. When you, as a DM, this is good words here to understand that when you find material, especially Greyhawk material or anything that inspires you, trust in what you want it to be and not necessarily what it is saying. So if you want something to happen in the campaign, that's up to you. That's yours to make it happen. And that's what Gygax is doing right here. And I think that's what he's saying. All right. We're getting very close to the end here. I think at this point, we've just made the introduction to the Green Dragon. So I think that it's time to call it a night here and call up Craig and kick him out. I'm sorry my voice was a little out today, but it just comes and goes. And I think that we've really covered some important points in what we've gone through here. We've seen the story progress, but I always find there's three elements. There is lore, which concerns the campaign. And then there are the mechanics, which concern mostly at this point. Gygax is talking in AD&D, first edition. And then thirdly, there is the story. Now, out of the three, you know, we're doing these readings, and they take about 45 hours to do a book. And the book could probably be read in 6 or 7. So for the most part, story is interesting. But story is perhaps the least. If story has things that are really lore, that's great. So I would say that, you know, we're seeing some very important stuff going on right here in story. We're introduced to various characters and things, but also we're seeing how the game has compressed. We've had an explanation of how magic works from Tenser, true or not. We have had the group, as far as the story goes, tracked down with the, you know, their idea, which seems to be correct, of where Omni and the second artifact must be. So as we're going through story, this has been a very, very important section we've gone right here. All right, I'm going to say goodnight to everybody. I'm going to call Craig in and boot him out the door. And I will be back tomorrow for recording number 24. All right.